This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The pharmaceutical business makes billions of dollars by devising sophisticated formulas to treat all kinds of ailments, from headaches to schizophrenia. But doctors still puzzle over the fact that a simple sugar pill can cure a lot of illnesses. It's called the placebo effect. It's a tendency to feel better when we think we're taking something to help us. The placebo effect is widely recognized. It's a phenomenon in medicine that doctors and researchers are asking if that can tell us something about how we treat patients, and can we use the placebo effect to develop better therapies. Joining us to talk about this is Norton Hadler. He is the professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of a number of books, including Rethinking Aging and the Citizen Patient. Norton Hadler, welcome back. Good day.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Allison Adcock, an assistant professor at the Duke University Institute for Brain Sciences. Allison Adcock, nice to have you here again.
Thank you.
And joining us again is Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke, author of several books, including Predictably Irrational and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Dan, good to have you back.
Great to be back.
Norton Hadler, tell us about the placebo effect. How long have we known about it? What do we know about it?
We've known about the placebo effect for a very long time. It was initially thought to be what it means in Latin. It was something doctors did to please you, with the full understanding on the part of the doctor that it shouldn't do nothing. It should do nothing of biochemical, biological significance. And in fact, as recently as when I was a boy in training, the Massachusetts General Hospital formulary had a whole bunch of preparations on the formulary, many of which were designed to be placebos. That always bothered me in training. Some were designed to be nocebos, things that you give people that they wouldn't like. That even bothered me more. And the modern history of the placebo starts with a man named Henry Beecher, who brought into scientific spotlight the notion of a placebo. He was a physician during World War II who was fascinated with the fact that not all injured soldiers needed opiates. In fact, some didn't want opiates, and he started doing a number of experiments. I actually knew him as a medical student. He was quite an extraordinary intellect and wrote a very important paper in the mid-50s called The Powerful Placebo, based on that kind of research, on the fact that if you have a susceptible mindset, you can get benefit in terms of pain, not in terms of wound healing and not in terms of the cure of cancer and not in terms of any major end organ damage, but in terms of coping. You could get benefit from something that was designed to be inert. And he spoke about the kinds of anxiety and the kinds of thinking that was part and parcel of the placebo effect, moving it away from fooling the patient and away from the notion that people who are susceptible to placebo effects are somehow lesser people. And then the next major event that happened was the amendment to the FDA laws in the late 60s, in 68, the Estes-Kefauver law, that for the first time ever demanded that before we license a drug, we have a randomized controlled trial, usually controlled by the placebo. And that notion set the placebo back from what Henry Beecher did, because the notion was that it ought to be, the new drug ought to be better than nothing. And what your introduction points out is that the treatment and the treatment act go hand in hand always. And that, in fact, what you're comparing with a placebo-controlled drug trial is two placebos, the placebo effect of the compound you labeled placebo and the placebo effect of the compound you labeled active drug. And what you're asking is whether there is more benefit on top of the placebo effect in the active drug. So your introduction is right on. This is a much more interesting, much more important part of the care of patients. And in fact, it speaks a lot to how we interact as people with each other in many, many contexts.
So, yeah, Dan Ariel, what's going on there?
So not giving the scientific part, but a personal reflection. So I was a burn patient for a long time. And when I was in the burn department, the doctors gave us a limit of how much painkillers we could take every day. And they basically limit the amount, but they allow the patient to decide when we're going to get each dose. And I of course, like every other patient, would track my own dosage, but I also tracked other people's dosages. I was kind of a little anal about this. And sometimes at night, some other patients would cry, and I would hear the nurse going to the room, injecting them with something, and then they would go to sleep. And I knew that this patient had more than their share of drugs. So I would call the nurse and I say, I don't want X to get more when I want more as well. Give me more. And sometimes they would tell me they just gave them placebos. They gave them IV fluid. And, you know, it's one thing to hear a description about placebo. It's another thing totally to lay in bed, have terrible pain, not being able to fall asleep, and knowing that somebody else is getting water with some salt and falling asleep. And I became fascinated with this phenomenon. It's really the body's ability to predict our own future, or the future the body thinks we're going to have, and make it a reality. It's beyond the medication itself. I think it provides a very interesting question about mind and body and soul and how we think about ourselves. And the way I currently think about it is that our brain largely tries to predict the future and then try to facilitate that future. So if you're hungry and you're going to have some meal, the body predicts that there's going to be some food and prepares salivation and all kinds of other things. If you predict that there's going to be some healing, some reduced pain, the body also gets into gear to facilitate that from happening. And whether something comes from the outside or not, the body's activity is going to happen. So it's about belief and about our own internal ability to change our physiology.
Now that is an excellent narrative for what it is that might be going on, a good way to explain a phenomenon that has been documented. So then I would go to the brain researcher, to the neuroscientist, and I would say, Allison Adcock, is there a way to test that? Is there a way to that this might show up on a scan, precisely what Dan Ariely described in narrative form?
Well, I think there are a couple of different components. So one is the specific prediction. So just in the same way that if you're expecting snakes in your yard because you saw one yesterday, every stick that you come across looks like a snake. We have ways of interpreting our own internal signals in similar ways. There's a really fascinating example of this by Carol Dweck and colleagues. There's an idea in the literature that making hard decisions wears you out cognitively. This is an ego depletion idea, right? And that if you make people make a bunch of hard decisions and then make them hypoglycemic, then
low blood sugar,
mm-hmm. Thank you. Then that ego depletion effect gets worse, and if you give them some sugar, then it gets better. So Carol showed that if you prime people with an idea that your cognitive resources are not finite, with statements like sometimes doing work invigorates me, then you don't see that dip with the hypoglycemia, and you don't rescue them. So they become insensitive to this physiological signal about what's happening in their body. So I think that's one piece of this, that you have an expectation, you interpret your internal signals in one light or another. And one of the things that my lab has been interested in is what are the physiological mechanisms that then translate that into doing better or doing worse? You know, how does that empower you to cope? And I think in the mental health field, this is particularly, so a lot of the placebo work is around pain, right? But in the mental health field, there's a lot of focus on coping and how we interact with our environment. So what we study is how the expectation, not just of a particular event, but of the value of that event to you, is it going to be good for you? Is it going to be bad for you? Drives different brain systems and changes your way of interacting with the world, changes your sense of competence, changes what you learn, and probably changes how you function in the world going forward.
As an example, might that mm-hmm. be, there's going to be a catastrophe, something awful is going to happen, but you're mm-hmm. somehow convinced that this will make you stronger, that mm-hmm. that by having endured this loss,
that's right,
I will become a better athlete. Or
that's
whatever.
Right. So the all of the drugs that we use in mental health treatment target these systems for meaning in one way or another. And the one that we focus the most on is dopamine, which seems to respond whenever you see a good thing or something to be avoided that you think you can get. So there's an action, there's an outcome, and you think you can make it happen. So you get a swell in dopamine. So when people are in that state, they have better perceptual signal to noise, so it's easier to detect things in the environment. They have better working memory and attention. They have better long-term memory and coding. They have better effort, vigor in pursuit of these goods. So there are lots of things that this neurotransmitter that's targeted by many of these drugs is doing to actually make the effort less, in addition to just making it look like it's worth your while. So it simultaneously focuses you on a goal and orchestrates brain systems to make it possible for you to get it.
But the fascinating thing about that is that it's a story that does that. It's a construction
that's
in your
exactly
mind
right.
that releases a chemical
that's
that
exactly
can
right.
then put you in a better place to cope.
Right. And we can manipulate this in the lab with incentives or expectations about the learning that people are engaging in and watch how their behavior in the environment changes and watch how the memory that they structure around that event changes.
Well, let's continue this conversation. Take a break right here. We're talking today about the placebo effect and what we know about it and what it can tell us about future therapies. With us on the State of Things is Allison Adcock, an assistant professor at Duke University Center for Brain Sciences. Norton Hadler is a professor. Professor of Medicine at UNC, Dan Ariely, Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. The broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the placebo effect and its influence on modern medicine. Dr. Norton Hadler is here, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of a number of books, including Rethinking Aging and The Citizen Patient. Dr. Allison Adcock is an assistant professor in Duke University's Institute for Brain Sciences, and Dan Ariely is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke. He's written lots of books, too. Predictably Irrational is one. The Honest Truth About Dishonesty is another. Norton Hadler, we've been talking a lot about, or some at least, about the placebo effect and its use for pain reduction or modification. Are there any other areas? Does it ever cure us?
Before we move to out of pain, can I say a few more things about pain? There was one experiment we did that I particularly like, is we changed the prices of medication. So what we basically did was we connected regular people to a device that gave them electrical shocks. And we measure how much pain they could take. And then we gave them pills and we tried to alleviate this pain by these pills. And these pills were placebos, of course. And some people we told that these placebos were expensive. And some people we told them they were cheap. Some we told them they were made in China, and some we told they were made in the U.S. The person giving them had a white coat. We had pens made. I mean, the logo was professional. The whole thing looked like a pharmaceutical endeavor, and they were part of the drug test. And what happened was that the expensive placebos worked much better than the cheap placebos. But to our surprise, the Chinese placebos worked just as well as the American placebos. And this was at a time when there were lots of all kinds of terrible news about Chinese products in the American market, like a toothpaste that was poisoned and all kinds of things like that. But in retrospect, I think that the reason is that Chinese medicine still has some halo effect around it. People still think of it as a good medication. But the price was actually a very large effect. And if you think about it, if you think something is expensive, your expectations going into it are much higher. If you think something is cheap, you're saying, I don't know why it's discounted and so on. And the question I think it brings to mind is, what are we doing when we get people to only pay a part of the cost of their prescription? So in the German system, the way I understand it is people pay the full amount for the medication and then they get the money back. But at least they see how much they pay. In the U.S., if you have a $5 copay and you never see the full amount, are we actually reducing to some degree the efficacy of medications?
Or you could give me the bill and I not pay it, and then I'll feel doubly good.
But the question is, will you pay attention to the price? So I really want you to realize how expensive it is. Maybe this explains the cost of American medicine.
Right.
It's all in pursuit of placebo.
No, because
there
then you'd
no
expect
rational explanation for the cost of American medicine.
And you would expect better outcomes, and we don't have those either. So no, it doesn't. I'm sorry, your experiment fails.
You could say, how worse would the outcomes be if we didn't have them? That's what
or you could think of other ways to make the medicine valuable and produce expectations of success besides price.
Sure. No, and in fact, preconceived notion is part of this so-called placebo effect. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's part of the therapeutic effect of the Treatment Act. There are a number of very similarly entertaining experiments. There was one done in Boston at the Brigham with people with persistent arm pain. A large population of people with persistent arm pain were randomized into two separate experiments. In one experiment, they got a a drug that may produce some benefit, not very effective, compared to a placebo pill. In the other experiment, they got acupuncture compared to placebo acupuncture. And the way that's done is the acupuncture needles are sheathed, so you don't know if they really went into your skin. And the reason for doing the experiment was to compare the two placebos, the placebo acupuncture with the placebo pill. Now, you got to realize people volunteer for these, and the kinds of folks who volunteer for these are the kinds of folks who are comfortable around acupuncturists. I'm not, so I would never have volunteered. And the result was that the placebo acupuncture was a more effective placebo. In fact, it was so effective that about 15% of the people undergoing placebo acupuncture said, ouch. And another 10% said, ouch, when the sheath needle was taken away. So there's a whole mindset that allows, and this has to do with preconceived notion, and we shouldn't think of this as bad or weak or negative or anything of the sort. What we need to learn more and more is how to take advantage of these insights. For example, we've known in chronic pain states, such as chronic persistent back pain or arm pain, usually in a contest, usually in a disability contest or a workers' compensation or legal contest, that opiates are terrible drugs. Mm-hmm. They don't seem to control pain. They're in fact, they seem to exacerbate the entire experience of pain. And that ought to be thought of as what Dan was mentioning. There's sort of a distinction between opiate-responsive pain, which is very chemical and very well understood and has led to multiple Nobel Prizes, and the notion of suffering, this notion that superimposed on whatever is opiate-sensitive pain is an entire mindset of mm-hmm. suffering for which opiates seem to be counterproductive. So there are ways to take this conversation into the therapeutic arena and be much more intelligent in the approach to people whose illness narrative, every illness narrative, has impressive symptomatology. That's what we hear from the patient is an illness narrative. And if the symptoms are subjective symptoms, as they often are, then there are a number of ways to help them aside from or in addition to some specific pharmaceutical intervention.
Well, what would you do in the lab with this kind of information, Allison? What does it tell you about the kind of research you want to do, knowing that this effect is so powerful?
Well, we have plenty of evidence for the kind of perceptual prediction that accounts for the ouch, right? So there's mounting evidence that what we think of it as that perception is not taking pictures with your brain's camera, right? It is this predictive process of matching the inputs to what you expect, and it's an interpretation, just like memory is an interpretation. I think that the more powerful piece of this is just thinking about how many different ways we can shore up our patients to make progress. And in psychiatry and mental health, we really talk about this quite explicitly as therapeutic alliance. So much of the focus of work in my laboratory right now is on figuring out what kinds of neuromodulators, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, that are targeted by these psychoactive psychiatric drugs, is elicited during social interactions and how that enhances learning. So we have very good evidence that these different tones, dopamine versus norepinephrine, that responds to reward expectation versus threat perception, change the way that you're interacting with your environment and the memories that you make, right? So how can we drive learning toward adaptive progress rather than freezing and rigidity, right? So that's a real focus in psychotherapy. And instead of applying a medicine that we use in the same way that we've been using antibiotics for the last 30 or 40 years, which is a steady state dose, we could manipulate these systems in a very dynamic way to tune the brain for a particular kind of learning. So that's the way that we've been thinking about it in my group, trying to drive these systems in a physiological way with the environment and interactions with individuals and potentially even teaching them to activate these systems on their own instead of this sort of steady state, always on just like antibiotic therapy that we've been using in psychiatry for 50 years since we discovered how powerful these drugs are.
So that sounds like it. What you're saying to some extent is you can use this information not necessarily to make more and different kinds of drugs, but to understand how the clinician and the practitioner can act and speak and create new social environments.
Or teach people to do it for themselves.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we do with wine, right? Yeah. If you think about it, so it's not in the medicine domain, but the moment you start calling wine tannin and complexity and acidity and you swirl it around and you smell it, all of a sudden you've changed dramatically what this grape juice tastes like and how much you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah, particularly if you're doing it with other people, right? I mean, and the
if other people can see you, that's wonderful.
And if you're doing it alone, that's a whole other set of problems. But if you're together,
right.
You know, there's probably a great therapeutic effect just in that.
Mm-hmm. But once you take the notion of the placebo into a broader context, as we're doing now, you begin to understand some of the healing involved in interpersonal relationships. There's a chapter in one of my earlier books, a book called Stab in the Back, that's titled, My Name is Norton and I'm a Placebo. And it's a discussion on bedside manner and what this means to be comforted by another human being. There are entire religious orders that have come into existence, many in the 20th century, based on the fact that for some people, in some contexts, this is one way to get symptom relief, and we should understand it less and less as metaphysics and more of the power of interactions, the power of preconception, the importance of otherwise no woman would ever have her second child.
Yeah, and if you think about the world of branding, a lot of it is kind of placebo-related, or it captures the same kind of mechanisms. And I'll just tell you about two studies we did. One study is we took golf players here at the Duke Club, and we gave them golf clubs that were either we told them were real or we told them were fake.
And then, fake golf club?
Well, counterfeits.
Okay.
Like, you know, made in China.
Oh, yeah, get it.
Not the real whatever.
Yeah, not a brand. It's a knockoff.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay.
And we measured how many shots they needed to put the ball into a few courses. And we saw that the counterfeits one did not perform as well, even though, of course, they were identical. But what was interesting is this effect was larger for people who were golf experts compared to golf novices. Mm. Because the novices don't care so much. It's the experts that care so much, and then it translates into a behavior. Another study we did was we gave people two beers, one regular beer and one the same beer with vinegar. And we asked them, try both of those. We didn't tell them anything about this. And tell us which one you like more. And the majority of the people like the one with vinegar more.
With vinegar.
And then another group of people, we told them in advance. We said, here's two beers. This is with vinegar. This is without. Try them both and tell us which one you want a glass of. So both people tasted the same thing. One group knew one of them had vinegar, by the way, balsamic vinegar, high-quality balsamic vinegar. And what happened is that not knowing about the vinegar made them like the vinegar. Knowing about it up front made them hate the one with the vinegar. So again, the taste, what you get from your tongue, is the same thing. But the moment you anticipate something to be different, it is going to be different. It's self-fulfilling prophecy is very, very strong. And maybe the most disturbing experiment on this was done in education, where they took school teachers and they told them, here's your class. These kids are not that good. These kids are really wonderful. And at the end of the year, they found indeed that the not-so-good kids got not-so-good grades. The wonderful kids got great grades, even though the assignment was random. So there was nothing in the initial assignment. But what happened was that the teacher expected a lot from the good kids. So they paid more attention to them. They smiled at them more. They did all kinds of things. They then create this self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you think about it, it just happens everywhere in lots of areas of our life.
Well, it's called the school-to-prison pipeline, and that is it's a very real phenomenon. You can measure it a thousand ways, and I think that's pretty good evidence. So, Allison, let me ask you this. Is this something – so you heard how dismissive I was of my anecdotal evidence, having grown up around nurses telling me about the effect of just listening, because there's been no study, so we don't know. But you've got all these scopes and scans. Is there a kind of placebo effect, and I mean that in the best way, in now having the neuroscience to back up some of the intuitions and anecdotal evidence and home remedies that have long been, you know, sort of intuitively thought effective, and now I've got something on a graph and a grant funded
well,
project.
Well, I think there is certainly a thriving field of research looking at placebo effect as relief of pain. And this is very rigorous research now demonstrating that placebos can change the quantitation of people's pain. So I think that that field is moving forward very rigorously and directly. I think the thing that we can move on in a broader sense is to think about what's produced, how many different ways can we produce those effects? So there's one that's about the expectation that Dan's very vividly describing examples of. And then there are all of these other sort of social neuroscience pieces. So we know that rejection is painful and stressful and produces decompensation in human beings. You know, we are really built to be connected to each other. And so thinking about the aspect, as you said, the aspect of, in which a human being is a placebo, so that the drug that you're giving to someone is contact, expression of support, a physical talisman of your connection to other human beings, I think is really where the money is.
Think about even shamanism, when you think about the enactment of certain expected outcomes, right, and within your culture it's an expected outcome, I may think it's crazy because I've never seen it before. I mean, a lot of that theater is what's going on. So my question, and I'm not asking you to validate shamanism here, I'm just talking about
the, but we're tiptoeing around that.
We're getting so perilously close.
Let's go there.
Well, let's go there. I mean, what about the mind is able to mirror, project, and take a look at theater and theatrical events and then somehow put yourself in the picture. Mirror neurons do that, don't they? I mean, our whole body takes on the aspect of someone else doing what we have had experience with, and it turns out a whole motor matrix is activated by me watching you do it.
Well, we're tiptoeing around definitions of culture and health. They're difficult definitions. They get fuzzier and fuzzier the more we get the science. I mean, am I justified, ethically justified, in fooling a patient? If I know that this is an interaction that involves the treatment act and not what I did, and I can give you a lot of examples of surgery for painful states that works when it's done actively or as a sham procedure. We now have several such trials. I think we need more than that. So that about a third of the patients are better whether they had the real operation or the sham operation, although the sham operation usually includes the sticking of needles or the cutting of skin or doing something like that. It is not a pretend event. And the argument can be made, wait a minute, if these sham things work, why don't we support the sham things and just don't tell the patient they're a sham thing? And there are a couple of responses in the bioethics community and a couple of responses in the clinical community that are at loggerheads. The bioethics communities can say, sure, do it. If it works, what's wrong with a placebo? And the clinical community says, wait a minute, you want me to lie to my patient, something that I find that I cannot do. So how do you handle this notion, this
You call it stents and you charge a lot of money for it.
There's a whole set of issues with stents. Let's not go there.
Let me ask you this.
With some of the orthopedic procedures that have been done this way.
But if it works, is it a sham? And so are you lying?
Isn't there
a way to put this so that you're not lying because you feel it works?
So there's one such experiment, actually, in response to critics like me. I mean, I I'll tell you how I get even more forceful as a critic of using shams. Even though I'm willing to admit that this is the treatment act that's working, but some people expect a treatment act that's pretty expensive. Some people expect one that is potentially dangerous. Some people need one that's painful. And this all relates to the way we talk at large, the social construction of health and the social construction of medicine. This is all a part of society that I think we need to address. But the way we deal with the issue of the sham procedure is as follows. There's another study out of the Harvard system, out of the Brigham. For patients who have an illness narrative that relates to a lot of bowel discomforts, it's usually called irritable bowel syndrome by those who like that label. And these folks volunteered for a trial where they were given the standard treatment versus a potion, a liquid that was labeled as this ought to be nothing. It may have some mind-body kinds of things to it, whatever that meant to the patient, but that's exactly how it was labeled, a placebo with potential for mind-body. And what we learned is that this is not as good a study as many others in this area, but it's very dramatic, that those people who volunteered found more palliation, felt better, thanks to the placebo mind-body than the standard treatment. If you look at the data, what it really looks to me like is that the placebo mind-body did as well as most placebos do. And in that context, the standard treatment did less well, so it became a nocebo. It was more harmful than the placebo. But it makes you pause and say, wait a minute, if you're totally convinced that there's a remedy out there, I could tell you it's a sham, and you'll still find it helpful.
I want to thank you all for joining us today. Fascinating conversation. Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University, author of such books as Predictably Irrational and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Dr. Allison Adcock, an assistant professor at Duke's Institute for Brain Sciences. Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, author of Rethinking Aging, The Citizen Patient, and many other books. To learn more about them, go to our website, stateofthings.org. Stay tuned.